Welcome to Issues and Ideas. I'm Larry Rutter.
Almost every single kid at school comes in with some amazing portable learning device in their hands or around their necks or in their backpacks. And in the beginning, when we didn't know how to bring that into the classroom, you know, the first reactions were to just keep those turned off. And now we're realizing, why would you ever want to shut down the power of that portable world at your hand, at your fingertips?
We're going to get a real education today because we're going to visit with the National Teacher of the Year.
Well, it's a sort of a backyard street scene with a black boxer in his sparring outfit.
Helmet and gloves.
Looking like he was ready. He was ready to go. The strength of it was what really overwhelmed us. As a matter of fact, when it was hanging in our house, there came a time when we needed to paint the walls. All the artwork came off the walls, and when Black King came off, the house fell down.
And then we're going to chat with the owners of a fascinating collection of paintings now on display at the Slo Museum of Art. But first, let's go to school. I read somewhere that there are 3.3 million public schools teachers in the United States. That alone tells you something about our guest who's with us here in the studio. Our guest was selected to be the 2012 National Teacher of the Year. Rebecca Milwaukee, welcome to the KCBX studios.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So you are a junior high, middle school teacher. You teach English in the seventh grade, and you've been doing it for a while, I guess.
Mm-hmm. 15 years, so I'm about halfway in.
Luther Burbank School, which is in Burbank, California.
Yes.
All right. Let's begin at what I think is the most important part of a discussion with any National Teacher of the Year. And what do you think are the biggest challenges that a teacher faces today? Maybe let's compare them with when you started in the business 14 years ago. Mm-hmm. What are the big challenges today that might surprise someone like me who's been out of it for quite a while?
Well, the words that people hear the most are the achievement gap, which is the differing levels of achievement between, white middle-class Americans and everyone else who are struggling to maintain the same levels of academic achievement. And that was something that was kind of thrown around and talked about when I started teaching. But in those 15 years, I saw not only achievement gaps opening up, but I saw opportunity gaps for kids not getting access to music and arts and sports and field trips and hands-on learning opportunities. I saw love gaps, parents both busy at work and having to work a lot longer day and thus unable to be at home and providing that kind of a supportive environment for kids to learn and achieve at home, safe places to do homework, hot meals many times a day. So you saw kids now not only struggling to measure up to their peers academically, but now trying to overcome all kinds of gaps in their lives. They needed food. They needed parental guidance. They needed role models and support. They needed food, clothing, school supplies. There was so much more that kids needed. And that teachers are having to fill those gaps.
I would think that one of the things that you would say is that the social media, the electronic media that is so ubiquitous today, that wasn't true 14 years ago. That must make a difference.
Definitely,
in terms of
yes.
Teacher.
Absolutely. I mean, I teach with tools right now in my classroom that didn't exist 5 years ago. And in five more years, I will be teaching and working with things that don't exist right now. And so having to stay nimble about with that and on top of it and being able to not be afraid of new technologies, to figure out how to use them and incorporate them into your classroom, and also not being afraid to harness the power of what kids already have. Almost every single kid at school comes in with some amazing portable learning device in their hands or around their necks or in their backpacks. And in the beginning, when we didn't know how to bring that into the classroom, you know, the first reactions were to just keep those turned off. And now we're realizing, why would you ever want to shut down the power of that portable world at your hand, at your fingertips? And so to try to figure out how to get what kids have, figure out what they have, how can we use it so that kids can learn and reach out into the world and become real world learners has been exciting to me. And I think to most good teachers, we're excited about using that technology.
But it isn't also a challenge. I mean, does it make the learning process different because they come with a different set of skills?
Absolutely, yes.
A different orientation to the world.
Absolutely. And it's in many ways more immediate, faster, they're more demanding. They want an authentic learning experience. They want it quickly. They want it right now. And the challenge for teachers today is to try to keep up with that. I mean, it's like a puppy who's you've taken out for a walk and the leash has gotten away from you. They take off and it's up to you to catch back up and grab that puppy and make sure they're safe. You know, the technology will always race ahead of us. We're seeing that right now. And it's not up to good teachers to stand still and cross your arms and say, come back to me where I'm at. It's incumbent on us to kind of catch up, figure out how it works, partner with kids, and educate ourselves at the same time about how to wisely use that technology so that learning can occur. Not all technology is a good use of our time in the classroom, but a lot of it sure is.
Uh-huh. But what about what it does to students' intellectual ability to learn? I'm thinking about you teach English, for mm-hmm. instance, mm-hmm. and the social media doesn't use standard English. Does that get in your way?
Well, I think what you do, I use the analogy of learning to ride a bike or even skateboard. You have to know how to do it, the essentials of it first, before you can start doing tricks and cut corners and make shortcuts and do something really snazzy. And so I tell them, when we're communicating, I need you to learn how to communicate perfectly first. And then in these different environments and arenas where you are communicating, I want you to tailor your words, your attitude, your tone to that world, that universe. So if it's you and I speaking, I'd like you to use correct grammar and proper sentence structures. If you're online tweeting, you're going to have to abbreviate and use acronyms. If you're on Facebook, you know, there are different arenas that we're all communicating in, and there are different rules for each one. That's our reality. And so I'm teaching kids how to survive in all of those places.
And is survival as likely today as it was 14 years ago?
Survival in the communication arenas?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. If anything, it's harder for them. You know, you and I had one thing to learn,
yes.
And then we could get creative. It was called creative writing, and we could take a liberty here or there with the way we wrote or spoke or punctuated. But now kids have to learn how to navigate Facebook and Twitter and MySpace and mom and dad and the classroom and the workplace. They have to know how to network in all of those areas. And so I think they have it harder, and thus their teachers have it harder.
When you teach English, what is the form in which you teach them to communicate? Is it the essay still?
Everything. No. Reading, writing, listening, and speaking. There are four prongs to what I think most teachers are doing in the classroom. I have to teach kids how to read critically and appreciate the written word. I have to teach them how to write in different genres and for different purposes, for different audiences. So they have to know how to write that five-paragraph essay, that classic old classroom standby. I have to teach them how to compose memos, emails, letters, tweets. I have to teach them how to ace a job interview. I have to teach them how to give a speech. I have to teach them how to listen carefully to politicians' arguments so they can really hear what's being said to them and make judgments about what they're hearing and how to act on those judgments. There are so many different ways that I'm asking kids to communicate back to me what they've learned.
And that's part of the English classroom?
Oh, yeah. It's all everything. We are singing, we're dancing, we're doing math in the classroom, we are building things and breaking it down, and the whole while we're reading about it, we're talking about it, we're writing about it. Kids are reading and writing a lot more even now than when I first started teaching. That's what's been great about the world speeding up the way it seems to have, is that now kids are expected to, you have to type and write to get out there in this world today. And maybe 10 years ago, you didn't have to.
When I learned to touch type when I was about 13 years old, only because my father did. My father was a writer. And I was a freak. There was nobody in my high school that knew how to touch type.
Right.
And now they all do.
They all do. Yeah, they're teaching us. That's the thing is, it's the world has spun around quite quickly, and now they're in a position to be teachers themselves.
We're talking with the 2012 National Teacher of the Year, Rebecca Milwaukee. She's from Burbank, and she has been on the hustings representing the teachers for a good portion of the last year, since last June, and will be till this June. I wanted to ask you about one of the highlights of that was meeting President Obama. White House ceremonies tend to be perfunctory. Was this fun?
Oh, goodness gracious. It was the most fun. You know, you get told a little bit about what to expect when you get there. And, you know, you're told you'll have very little time with the president. So if you're going to say anything at all, it had better be fairly succinct. And I had that right in my mind what I planned to say. And from the moment he said hello, all bets were off. The script shifted completely. And he, as always, as you can imagine, was very warm and genuine and very open and talkative. We talked about being bad students in middle school and caring more about getting our colleagues to laugh at us than getting our work turned in on time. And I told him I was pretty good now. If he needed help with his homework tonight, I could help him. I was in town. And we just laughed. We talked about our children. We talked about being parents. We had a good number of laughs. And then when it was time for the ceremony, I thought, okay, party's over. It's time to go to work. And that once we got out on stage in the East Room, things would take a much more serious turn. And from the moment he started to talk about me, he made jokes. He razzed me a little bit. He teased me, called me a couple of names. We fist bumped at the podium, and that was a trip. When I went in to fist bump him, he initiated, and I immediately, my mother's voice came into my head and said, "You do not put your hands on the President of the United States." And I just shot my arms down at my side and just kind of chuckled along with him. And it just went from being a really wonderful morning to the most incredible day of my life. And it was so emblematic of me and my goofy personality and of who he is.
One of the things that president would like to do is to see universal preschool. Mm-hmm. That's one of the initiatives that they're dealing with right now. So make a difference?
I really do think it does. If you can have kids enter school with as close to the same starting point as possible, that would be a nice way of leveling the playing field for children. Those first 4 years, preschool through fourth grade, are essential. There are certain targets with reading and literacy and mathematics that kids gain in those first 4 years that if we don't have all kids on the same page with those same opportunities to rich print worlds and lots of language and lots of socializing and lots of teamwork and collaboration, they can move into the later grades well behind their peers. So if this is something that we can make happen, and I do believe we can, it will benefit society completely.
In your classroom, do you see the difference? I mean, do you see children who have had a preschool intellectual experience mm-hmm. and those that haven't? It makes a difference by the time they get to middle school?
It's not quite as black and white as that, but you can certainly tell a difference between kids for whom literacy is a big part of their world. You know, whether they're surrounded by the printed material, whether they're being talked to at a high level on a daily basis, whether they're immersed in after school or enrichment activities that stimulate the mind. You can tell a difference between kids who have that and kids who don't. And I think great schools all over this country are seeking to give to kids those types of experiences within their school day or immediately before or just after. And the thing that troubles me the most is that in the 15 years I've been teaching, I've seen nothing but cuts to education. Every single year, something goes. And the last of it is teacher salary. I care, that's the least of my concerns. What I care the most about is you shouldn't have a school of children sharing a computer. You know, could you imagine coming to your workplace and knowing that today's not your day to touch a computer? Your day's next Thursday from 2 to 3. And if all of you here had to share that, how little productivity could actually occur? Or to know that you haven't gotten a new textbook in 9, 10, 12 years. The textbooks you do have are falling apart. In this nation, in this superpower, in this glorious place we call America, how can it be that we have continued to gut public education at the same time we talk about what a pride it is of our nation and how we provide world-class education and how we're seeking to be number one internationally when we keep cutting school budgets and offering so very little to children in the way of what they need to be competitive globally? That's the thing that's the heartbreak for teachers like me and all the other 3.2 million is we see it happening. There's very little we can do to stop that other than vote and be politically active. And so we're finding we're just dancing as fast as we can with the partners that we do have in the classroom. We're bringing in materials from home. We're searching for them online. We're making copies on our own dime. We're getting speakers to come in for free. We're just doing everything we can so that those schools don't fail those kids. And you know, I know it'll be shocking to say this or to even hear it, but, you know, sometimes I feel like I've been left holding the bag because teachers certainly have been blamed for almost all of public school failure. And I feel like, well, hold on a minute. You put me into a system that's not fully funded. You send to me kids who are experiencing challenges in their lives at home that are unprecedented in this economy. And it's that lack of leadership, that lack of money, and that those challenges at home that make my job so incredibly difficult that when I do have a success, it's a miracle. And I'm so proud of it. And I protect it with my life. And so then to be kicked around as a teacher in the media and by other people, it's really a heartbreak. It's a heartbreak. But it doesn't get me down. I'm going to keep working hard. I come to work with a smile every day. There's just so much work to do and so many kids' lives to improve. And education does do that.
Just a pause in our conversation with Rebecca Milwaukee, the National Teacher of the Year. We'll rejoin her shortly when she says,
I think we're coming out of an era where boys were seen as defective girls.
After that chat, we're going to talk with the owners of the dramatic collection of oil paintings on display at the Slo Museum of Art.
Well, we have favorites that came our way. One is The Fringe Scarf by Marion Greenwood, and that's a solemn-looking black girl with a fringed red scarf, and her eyes follow us wherever we go, and we tend to stop and acknowledge her. She has been a true friend in the house.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. This is Issues and Ideas. We return now to our conversation with Rebecca Milwaukee, a middle school teacher from Burbank, California, and the National Teacher of the Year. You've got something in your background that I think our listeners would be interested in, and that is you are a Cal Poly graduate.
A proud Mustang, absolutely, yes. I graduated in 1990 with a speech communication major. My father went to Cal Poly to get his master's degree in counseling, and he himself, after a career in the Army, went to become a high school counselor and teacher. And he was determined that one of his three daughters would come to Cal Poly, and he would drive us down here every summer to see the campus. And I was the last of the Mohicans, the last daughter, and saw campus and saw how beautiful it was. And I think there might have been a cute boy or two that I spotted out the car window. And I said, yep, that's the school for me. And I loved every minute of my time here. I met my husband at KCPR at the radio station. The minute I laid eyes on him, I knew he was the one for me. And that was 25 years ago. We're still together.
You know, when I think back on my own education, I think the teachers that had the greatest influence on me, the ones that I think back on fondly or think about as having had an influence, never knew it.
Oh, my gosh, that's so true. And I say this a lot. We remember the teachers who said you can and the ones who said you can't. You never know the impact that you're making on kids. You know you are. When you teach, you know you have a ripple effect, but you don't know where those ripples are going to go, and you don't know how big or small they'll be. And you just keep doing it because, you know, it's like watering a garden that blooms someplace else and far away from you many, many years from now. But it does bloom. You're not always there to see it. But sometimes you'll get word back that one of your kids has really, really made it, or they come back themselves and tell you. And those days, those are million-dollar days.
You brought a young, handsome son into the studio with us now, and he looks like a pretty bright kid to me. I worry today about males, about boys in school not doing nearly as well compared to girls in school. Am I mistaken about that?
I think we're coming out of an era where boys were seen as defective girls, you know, where the hallmark of a strong classroom from the outside was a class where kids were sitting quietly at their desks, hands folded, or pen, you know, hand clasped around a pen, writing quietly, teacher at the front of the room, and a very orderly environment. And in that environment, boys don't always thrive. They are active human beings, and they are filled with energies that could power whole cities. They need to get up. They need to move. They need to see how learning works in the world and what it looks like. I think we're coming out of that time, and technology is helping us because technology is very hands-on. It's very interactive. It requires movement and input, and that's right up boys' and girls' alleys. So if you were to enter a classroom today, it would not look like the classrooms of our day. You would see a hive of activity. You would have a hard time finding the teacher because they would be among the kids. And what you would see would be teams of kids working together to solve interesting challenges or problems or creating products in the classroom. It's a world that I hope allows both boys and girls to thrive.
In some of the material that you sent out, you had some advice to new teachers. I think there were 9 items in it. Mm. Some of them was seemed to me to be fairly obvious, but a few others I thought were interesting, and I wanted to ask you about
yes.
some of those. You probably wrote that a long time ago and may not even remember what's on it, but let's take a chance. And the second one, it's all about the pencil.
Oh, right. Yes.
Now, what did you mean by that?
Well, when you're a new teacher, you have this real zealous sense that your job is to not just teach your content, but also to teach responsibility. It's a big, big deal to you when you're a young teacher. And so you end up fighting battles over the homework. Where is it? Why don't you have it? The handout, where is it? I gave it to you. You lost it. I'm not giving you another one. Or kids turn up without books or pencils, or they're missing something that's so essential to your class going forward. And when you're a new teacher, you end up sort of fighting that battle to try to teach children responsibility, and you'll end up making decisions that actually don't help that child or you go forward. You will not give them a pencil if they don't have one, or force them to go find one somewhere else, or you refuse to give them another handout because it's the third one they've lost from you, and when are they going to finally wise up and get responsible? And you end up fighting all these battles for the purpose of teaching them responsibility, but it doesn't end up advancing your instruction or their learning. Saw a teacher and was mentored by a teacher who said, you need to swat away any and all distractions. Think of yourself as the quarterback carrying the ball into the end zone. Let nothing stand in your way between you and those kids and what you need to accomplish each day. It can't be a pencil. It can't be a handout. It can't be a call slip or an announcement over the speaker. You have to keep going. The world will teach kids responsibility. When you go into workplaces, everybody's got their car keys and their phones and they've got pants on. The world will teach them to show up with what they need. So have faith that that will happen. But in your class, you're the only person that can deliver English instruction to those kids. And you've got 52 minutes to do it. Don't waste your time on the pencil.
But isn't that the ultimate tension in any classroom, which is the tension between citizenship and learning?
Citizenship happens because when you tell a kid, I value what we have to do today more than your temporary failure to bring the pencil, that your learning and your improvement mentally matters more to me. No kid likes to be singled out for not having their supplies, and they certainly take their fair share of attention and heat from their classmates, and that I don't have control over. And no one likes to be the kid that always forgets their work or always forgets their pencil. After a while, that starts to be a time waster of its own. And the universe corrects that. They decide, you know, I don't want that to happen to me for the third time this week. And eventually that kid that maybe forgot something the entire first week of school gets their act together. And then you don't have to worry about that anymore.
Another subject that is often the most common subject at the national level about education mm-hmm. is testing.
Mm-hmm.
As a teacher, standardized testing,
yes.
being rewarded for good test scores and punished for bad test scores, how do you feel about that?
I did not enter teaching right out of college. I came from the business world. I worked in publishing where you had to mind the budget, you had to get results, you had to deliver a high-quality product to your customers. That was the bottom line. And when I entered a classroom and started teaching and found out that nobody really checked to see if I was performing very well. And nobody really cared whether or not my kids could achieve. And I got to keep my job even if they didn't. I couldn't square with that. I just mentally could not realize that I'd come to a place now where all kind of normal rules in the business world did not apply to me in the classroom. And I thought, that can't be. And I set those standards for myself. It's very important to me that my kids learn and that I can prove that they've learned. Now, do I think their state standardized assessment scores are the proof of that? Not even close. It's one number. It would be like going to the doctor and having your temperature taken. It's a vital sign, but it in no way paints the whole picture of your health or my students', you know, smarts academically. So I have to look at all of what they can do. And I would be proud to show you all of what my kids can do. They can read, they can write, they can think on demand. If you looked at their writing, you'd be proud of what you saw. If they stood up at a city council meeting and made an impassioned argument about a park or something related to schools or their community, you'd be proud of what they said. They're good people. They're friends. They don't bully anybody. They're very, very concerned about the planet and our world. And they can create things and they can solve problems. I'm so proud of the whole of what my kids can do that when we want to narrow the conversation down to that one number that you spoke of and punish teachers who don't get great numbers on test scores and reward those who do, why? I mean, that would be like saying you're completely healthy. You get a prize if you have 98.6 as your temperature. That's not the right way to go about it. That's probably a terrible analogy. Give me a minute. I could think of a better one. But it's just the wrong road. We're going down the wrong road.
Just want to thank you very much, Rebecca Milwaukee, 2012 Teacher of the Year, for stopping by our studios and sharing with us some very interesting insights into education.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And everybody out there listening, go hug a teacher. We need it.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Larry Rutter. In just a minute, we'll visit with Arthur and Marilyn Rosenberg, whose American Scene collection of oils is on display this month at the Slo Museum of Art. And now we return to Issues and Ideas. I try to see most of the special exhibits at the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art, and in recent memory there have been many excellent ones. But the one featured this month just blew me away. I loved it. I fell in love with it. It's brimming with life, with stories, with real human beings. The exhibit is all part of a personal collection of two Central Coast residents there, Arthur and Marilyn Rosenberg. And their collection is called American Scene. Both Arthur and Marilyn Rosenberg, we're honored to have you both with us here in the studio.
Well, we're honored to be here.
It's a wonderful collection. How the devil did you get so much good artwork?
It's a long story, but we'll try to keep it short. We started out in Brooklyn, where our experiences with art were very limited. Manhattan was across the bridge. We didn't really go there. We went to Europe via the Air Force. Marilyn accompanied me, and there we were introduced to the fine art of Europe. And on returning home, we found that New York is the art capital of the world. Why weren't we paying attention? And so we became members of a variety of museums, the Whitney, the MoMA, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and those were our haunts. We weren't really able to collect anything, and our walls were empty, but we did buy posters of famous works of art, but that was just paper. And then we seemed to find very big posters by Charest, Steinlin, Grasset, and that filled up the walls. But again, that was paper. By chance, we fell into a art gallery in Long Island where we lived, and it was almost like a club-like atmosphere. Collectors would sit around and just talk about almost anything, but eventually the owner would bring us all back to the art for sale. And she went into the back and introduced us to a painting that was covered with dust. I don't know how long it had been back there. We both fell in love with it immediately. It was called Black King, black boxer with his helper tying his shoelaces. And we just couldn't imagine owning this painting in a house full of country antiques. Well, the owner said, take it home. See how it fits in. See if you like it in your house. Well, we brought it home, and it never came off the wall.
I'd like to add, though, that we really didn't love it at first sight.
Really?
Well, it was strange, you know, to live.
Describe the painting in some detail so that we can at least give our radio listeners a visual picture of that painting, which is kind of the centerpiece of the exhibit at the museum.
Well, it's a sort of a backyard street scene with a black boxer in his sparring outfit.
Helmet and gloves.
Looking like he was ready. He was ready to go. And it was had interesting colors and a geometric shape that attracted us. The strength of it was what really overwhelmed us. As a matter of fact, when it was hanging in our house, there came a time when we needed to paint the walls. And all the artwork came off the walls. And when Black King came off, the house fell down.
That's
he was supporting the house.
Yeah, that's when I knew how much I really loved him.
You know, I would describe your collection as being sort of urban Americana between the world wars.
It's exactly what
correct.
It is.
Many of the subjects but are black. Many of them are obviously not wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost all in an urban setting.
Well, it was the first time that a man, common man, was being painted. And I think that's what attracted us. We originally were looking at other periods of American art, but this seemed to, considering our backgrounds in Brooklyn, this was the most appealing.
We're talking with Arthur and Marilyn Rosenberg. Their collection, called American Scene, is at the Slo Museum of Art to the end of this month. And I'm really taken by it, and I was really curious about the people who collected it and the ways in which they collected. So here they are with us in the studio. Black King was sort of the beginning of your collecting.
That was number one.
Beginner's luck.
And it really was beginner's luck, because we found an auction at Christie's where two Fletcher Martin paintings, or Black King is by Fletcher Martin,
right.
They were being sold off from the Mike Minucci collection. He was a restaurateur in Manhattan, and he had these two sports scenes, one a boxer and another one a baseball scene, out at home. And they were going off for auction, and Marilyn went to the auction, and when the number reached a high number, there was Marilyn overjoyed with the idea of having a winner in the house.
It wasn't the money, because we weren't selling it, and we still own it. It was the confirmation of our good taste.
There was something I read that said that you had some advantage because you weren't in the business of reselling paintings. This is going to be your collection. This is going to be in your home. So maybe you could pay more than a gallery who had to make a profit on it.
Well, this is called the neglected generation, and it was a big advantage to us because at the auctions there were very few collectors. It was mostly art dealers, and since we didn't have to resell it, we could go a little bit higher than they could and get the paintings that we wanted.
Hmm. They're very gritty. They almost each one of them seems to tell a story, doesn't it? You can almost sit down and say, now that person, I can see a story there.
Well, we have favorites that came our way. One is The Fringe Scarf by Marion Greenwood. And that's a solemn-looking black girl with a fringed red scarf, and her eyes follow us wherever we go. And we tend to stop and acknowledge her. She has been a true friend in the house. Well, we didn't have enough knowledge to trust ourselves when we went to galleries and auctions, so we made a study to begin with. And there's a bookstore in Manhattan called The Strand.
Been there many times.
Well,
it's a fun place.
If they don't have the book, it wasn't published. They had a collection by the Encyclopedia Britannica that was a collection of American art in 1944 that they toured the country with. They actually came to the DeYoung Museum, and it was one of the biggest turnouts they ever had. It was the most important artists in the then 48 states. It was curated by museum directors, artists, critics, art critics, and they collected from across the United States the most important artists who were hanging in all the major museums. We made a list. These are the artists we have to find. Unfortunate for the artists, the abstract expressionists came to America in the late 40s, and all the major museums took the paintings down that were our painters and needed the wall space for all these giant black on whites and Mark Rothko, three big color masses, Motherwell. And of course, these artists went to the basement.
What an advantage to us.
Yeah.
Nobody was interested. They call them the neglected generation because they were totally out of favor. And it was a way to buy the best examples of the artists we could find, the major paintings, at what we consider to be reasonable prices. And we wouldn't have been able to do that in any other period of art that we were interested in collecting. So it was a really rare opportunity.
One of the ones that struck me, one of the paintings, is called Pearl Primus by Marianne Greenwood.
Yes.
It's a picture of a black woman, elegant, attractive black in a dress, kind of leaning back against a wall.
She was a Harlem dancer.
She was a Harlem dancer. Was she a real person?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Yeah. We cut out the obituary from the New York Times when she died about 8 years ago.
Oh, really?
She was a real person. She was a star.
Huh.
Pearl Primus, yes, in Harlem. Huh. Hard to get tickets to see her perform.
I think I commented when I saw this last Friday night that your house must be very noisy because each one of these paintings has a story. I mean, I had no idea she was a Harlem dancer. I just saw the name on it. It didn't mean anything to me. But I could impute a story to her easily.
Right now, it's a very empty and quiet house.
Yeah, I imagine it is.
We have a few paintings that were left behind, and they keep complaining. Weren't we good enough?
What was your most exciting find? Now, your first one, of course, is your baby. That's your firstborn. But over the years, is there something in this collection that when you found it, you said, oh, my gosh, this is incredible? Maybe there are more than that. But what's the one that stands out?
Well, we had a lot of adventures in gathering this collection. And there was one episode where a local to Long Island, art dealer contacted us that he had several paintings for sale. And we went to look at them, and we were prepared for one painting.
He had three.
A stretch for two, and it was going to not happen for three. Unfortunately, he had three winners, and we had to make a decision. So one was the fringe scarf, which we loved. The other was an Aaron Borod, the secretary, who we also loved. But the third was a Kenneth Hayes Miller, typical 1930s woman shopper. And I decided that the little dog in the corner wasn't done well enough.
This is the little dog was an element in the...
An element in the picture. The shopper had her typical hat from the period, little plump. It was typical Kenneth Hayes Miller, who was one of the really important teachers at the Art Students League. Well, we took home two. We left behind the shopper. Almost a month goes by, and we're at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And who would they hang? A Kenneth Hayes Miller shopper. And I'm saying, I'm never going to forget that shopper.
And I haven't let
him forget. That's the one that got away.
Oh, my God.
So it's a reverse memorable moment.
Oh.
The one that got away, it sticks with me.
My goodness. Now, this wasn't the identical painting that was
so similar because he was known for doing that genre. And there it was. We had an opportunity. And, well, I don't think we could have done. I don't know which one we would have left behind if we took the Kenneth Hayes Miller. But it wasn't fair for him to offer three at one time.
Now, you have your own favorites. You're exhibiting at the Slow Museum of Art now. And people go around and comment. Have you been surprised at all about the paintings that maybe have stood out to people that don't stand out to you?
Actually, I noticed a lot of people standing at a small drawing that was done by Joseph Solman. And he did it on the way to the racetrack on the New York Times. He made these little paintings of the people, little drawings of people.
On the newsprint.
Oh.
And it was not one of our major acquisitions, and yet I've seen a lot of people looking at it, which surprised me.
But it's not like that painting Well, it's a watercolor. He would use like the Wall Street section to do a hobo. He would have tongue-in-cheek with some of it. And the one that we have is a woman on the subway riding in, reminds me of my mother. So I like that picture.
But actually, years later in Architectural Digest, I saw the home of George Stephanopoulos, and he had four of those sketches on his mantle.
Isn't that interesting?
Which is interesting.
So we knew that we did it right.
Arthur and Marilyn Rosenberg are our guests here, and they are the collectors of a collection called American Scene that's appearing through the end of this month at the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art. Are there still paintings in that era available that people are collecting, that you're collecting, or is it kind of a – have you been outpaced by the galleries?
Well, we wanted – when we moved to California, they were doing the same kind of work on the West Coast, and there were many artists that were comparable that we did want to add to our collection with these paintings, but the prices had already gotten away from us, so we never did.
The paintings came out of an era of an unsettled era, mm-hmm. really, in the United States, yeah. between the wars. And I remember reading one of the things that you talked about, Arthur, that going to the Marxist League, I think, to buy some paintings.
Marilyn was hoping we wouldn't discuss that. but it's a favorite story of mine.
Tell me.
There was an ad in the New York Times, classified, that a list of our artists were for sale at the Lenin Marxist Library. So we went, and before we entered, I told Marilyn to smile. The FBI just took your picture. And we went up, and there was a big hall with many paintings hanging, and there was a notice that Mervyn Jules, one of the artists on our to-get list that we never got, mm-hmm. was going to speak at 1 o'clock. So we made sure to get back for the talk at 1 o'clock, and this was a guy who really represented that era. He was fortunate enough to have a teaching job at Smith College, and all his friends didn't, and were on the dole through the WPA, making $21 a week, and they then became known as WPA artists.
They were busy painting murals in our post offices.
Oh.
Well, he was disappointed with the fact that he is not a WPA artist, because everything that goes with it, he lost. He had a job. But at that Marxist-Lenin library, there was one major painting by Raphael Sawyer, and they wanted $45,000 for it. I am sure in a gallery it would be much more. He's a very important American artist. And the question was, how did they get in possession of that piece of work? Well, it turns out one of the members' fathers was a tailor, and he made Raphael a suit, and Raphael gave him a painting. So during the Depression, a lot of things were bartered, and that's how they survived. It made the visit really interesting. Many of them were part of what's called the 14th Street scene. New York artists sharing models, taking vacations together out on Long Island.
Woodstock.
And in Woodstock. This was a group. The color, the palette, very similar. And if you recognized the model, you knew they were sharing this model. Made for an interesting afternoon. We did come home with a Sikofsky watercolor. Not a major painting, but one of the patrons of the museum fell in love with it, which I couldn't understand, but she was attracted to it.
You never ask a question usually that you don't know the answer to, and I don't know the answer to this, so it may be off. But so many of your paintings tell a story. And I'm wondering, have any of your paintings been used to illustrate short stories or illustrate magazine articles or anything like that?
We have Joseph Hirsch that was an illustration for
the cover of the Saturday Evening Post.
Oh, really?
For an article. It's called Solidarity. Management's in the middle, all beaten up, and two workers are helping him. Basically, I don't know what the article was about, but this was an illustration for it.
And it's one of your paintings in
yes.
your collection?
Yeah, yes. It's at the museum now.
That's right. Well, now, my feeling is we could talk all afternoon about this, but I think our listeners would want to go on to other things. But I do want them to go and see this exhibit. I think it's terrific.
Well, thank you.
I really think it's great. SLO Museum of Art, I think, is open every day, 11 to 5, except Mondays. I think they're closed on Mondays.
Tuesday.
or Tuesdays, absolutely. But call up the museum. That can give you the deal. You definitely want to check out this collection. It's marvelous. And we want to thank Arthur and Marilyn Rosenberg for joining us here in the studio and sharing their collecting zeal. And anybody who has a chance to see this will thank you as well for the artwork that you presented for us here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Larry Rutter.